Relentless Roger and the Caveman Doctor, Episode 17. Today we ask, can something as simple as walking and breathing right change your life? And is stevia the safest sweetener around? Roger and the Caveman Doctor, Episode 17. I am Relentless Roger, here with Dr. Colin Chant, the Caveman Doctor. What's up, my friend?
It is a busy time for Roger and myself. We are just getting destroyed at work.
Destroyed.
We're actually laughing about it, so it's fine. A lot of excitement in my life. My sister got married last week, so it was pretty awesome. Got to go back to the City of Champions for that.
Congratulations to her, but I am happy to say that Pittsburgh Steelers lost pretty handily in week one.
That's all right.
Not like the Eagles looked impressive, but
yeah, you guys were much uglier than the Steelers. Luckily, you're playing
the Browns. A W is a W. Yeah.
Funny thing there, as I was picking up cookies for her wedding, it's a Pittsburgh thing, everyone does cookies. And the woman who apparently she makes like some of the best cookies in Pittsburgh, she's a friend of a friend. She's actually a listener of this podcast. So if you're listening out there, your cookies are apparently the best. But it was funny because she offered me a cookie when I went to pick them up. And obviously I said no, but she didn't know that I'm the person on this podcast.
Oh, man.
So after the fact, she's like, I can't believe I offered him a cookie. So it was kind of hilarious. And then otherwise, rough day. Started the day out today by eating. So I eat raw egg yolks in the morning. They tasted a little bit funky.
Oh, no.
And I ate orange peppers beforehand, so I think that was why. And then I cut open a brand new avocado, brand new from Whole Foods, slice it in half, pop out the core, whatever that's called in the middle. Yeah. And as I'm eating it, I see something moving out of the corner of my eye. And there was a larva that fell down and it was coming up a spider web, and I looked and the other side of the avocado was just full of larva.
Oh, man.
I threw it away. I had a bite of it from the top.
Come on, man. Just pound down those larvae.
Back in the day, they would have, but wow. And I went to work like a minute later and was just disgusted, and everyone asked what was wrong. And I said, and they all said the same thing. They're like, okay, caveman. I thought you'd eat a caveman. anyway, so yeah, that's what's new with me. What's up with you?
Oh, it's same deal. We are truly getting destroyed, but it's in the best of ways. Actually, we're kicking off two dual transformation programs this season, one live and one virtual. So it's hectic, but it's pretty amazing because you see a lot of motivated individuals, a lot of individuals who have, you know, kind of come to the table wanting to change something. And I think I may have referred to this way back when we started this podcast and another one of those transformations was kicking off, but it really is an inspiring time. And so I appreciate, and I think I'm in turn fueled by, as a trainer, the effort of those people who come.
I'm sure.
So that's what's going on this week. And I'm ready for a podcast, man. Let's I think we are dedicated, you know, through it all. We will.
Through it all. Oh, big news prevail. Too. We made it out past midnight. We went out on Saturday, made it out past midnight, which
through
was
one of the trainers at Relentless Fitness. Happy birthday, Jess. So we all went out to celebrate Jess's birthday, and it was a good time.
It was a good time. I'm just surprised we weren't yawning and falling asleep.
So, yeah, somehow, some way, we made it past the turn into a pumpkin moment.
Absolutely. So let's start out with a reader question, and this is a question that we've been asked before, time and time again. So I am thankful for Sharon for reminding us of this question, but she asked about stevia. Stevia is a sweetener it's basically ground up plant leaf. It is very, very sweet, and it's low calorie, low carbohydrate. She asks, can it raise insulin? And it's a great question. You know, if we're trying to not eat carbohydrates, in theory, we should not be trying to raise insulin, since that's one of the big issues with carbohydrates.
Sure.
And, you know, briefly, there's definitely some in vitro studies, in vitro being on a Petri dish. And it does. It does raise insulin in a Petri dish. I don't know what that tells us in an animal or human being. And animal studies also showed that it does raise insulin levels. But other studies actually show it's an insulin sensitizer, so it makes insulin work that much better. So, you know, I don't know how to take that. If it raises it, but it's sensitizing at the same time, that brings up an interesting question. Well, actually, there's a recent article. It's in a journal called Appetite, which is just an amazing title of a journal.
Nice.
It's one of the only studies where they looked at stevia in humans. There's some animal data out there, which I'm not going to quote you. And what they did in this study is they looked at stevia, aspartame, and sucrose, sucrose being sugar. They looked at food intake, satiety, so that's hunger, and postprandial glucose and insulin levels, and they compared them. Aspartame is in Diet Coke. It's kind of one of the more common artificial sweeteners out there. So very interesting study. They took 19 healthy, lean people and 12 obese individuals, 18 to 50 years old. They put them on these preload meals containing stevia, aspartame, or sucrose. And interestingly, postprandial, so that's after you eat, postprandial insulin levels did rise in all three, but in the stevia, they rose much, much less than the aspartame or the sucrose. So aspartame.
Interesting.
Yeah, aspartame sounds like it's more along the lines of jacking up your insulin like a sugar, which I don't know about your guys' experience out there, the listeners, but I know when I used to drink Diet Coke, I never felt totally right after. Like, I felt like my blood glucose was kind of going up and down. And stevia right now is a sweetener that I do have in my protein shakes that I use prior to workout. Which that brings up another good point. If it does raise your insulin, but you're only doing it before or after a workout, is it that big of an issue? It's definitely better than eating any of the sugars. It's better than aspartame. And the other thing is, if it's actually insulin sensitizing, which before and after a workout, well, especially after a workout, you're going to be insulin sensitized anyway from the workout alone. I don't know if it's that big of a deal.
Right.
If you're throwing it in your coffee, if you're putting it in throughout the rest of the day, it probably is going to bump up your insulin a little bit. You know, it depends on where you are. If you can cut it out totally, I would say to cut it out. If you can't, and it's replacing using sugar or some other thing that's a lot worse, I think it's right now it's the best case scenario. You know, it's the new kid on the block, so there's not a ton of research on it. But I think right now it is the best bet of a artificial sweetener. What do you think?
Yeah. You know, I have a sort of a pro and a con. The pro is on the use side. We talk about this a lot, and it really comes down to how you use something. And again, if you're overboard on sugar and you're using stevia as a replacement for that sugar, then I think that's a positive use. And in that case, I would definitely say continue on with the stevia. And then, as we've said on some other shows, if you do get to a point where you can in turn kick out even stevia, then definitely do so if you've progressed that far. Right? Would you agree with that?
I totally agree.
Then the other thing, my con, is I would agree with what you briefly mentioned. It's the new kid on the block. And I'm just concerned about the future of stevia.
Yeah.
Right? At what point will there be a point where something negative does come out about it? Just as, you know, aspartame at one point or another was the new kid on the block and people loved it.
Yeah.
And it was put in everything.
The one reassuring thing is it is somewhat more natural. I'm sure there's a lot of processing that goes into it.
But it's still unnaturally, you know, exponents sweeter than anything we're used to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's just the one thing I worry about. You know, the Frankenfoods and the concoctions of the food industry and just something that is, I don't know, what's the number on stevia? It's like 100 times or it's something preposterous.
They always say some crazy,
yeah,
300 times. It has a black licorice taste to it too. So
yeah.
It's not like, you can't compare it with sugar.
That's true. But whatever truth there is to the how many multiples sweeter it is than what we're used to, that always troubles me.
Yeah.
That stuff just gets me. So
no, I'm with you.
I don't know. That's what I worry. So I'd say the pro is, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's better than sugar. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably better than aspartame, or at least, I mean, I don't think it's any worse.
Yeah, I think it's better than aspartame.
Right?
I think aspartame is not good, not a good player. I would avoid by all means.
Yeah. So, I mean, so we definitely have some players that it outperforms.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you use it? And like you said, I mean, the stuff that's in your protein shake, I mean, how much are you really using?
You know? Very minimal. So.
Right, and you're using it around workouts, like you said. So that's probably best case scenario of stevia usage, right?
I would agree. There you have it. Stevia, we're lukewarm.
Lukewarm. But as always, proceed N equals one, right? It is all about you. It's about nobody else. It comes down to how you personally will use it. And also just how much you enjoy it, you know? If it's not something you enjoy at all, then just get it the heck out.
I agree. Let's hit up some workout discussions.
Hit up some HIIT.
What do you got?
All right, so this was posted about a week ago by Keith Norris. I know we bring up Keith a lot, but there's a reason. He is a workout guru. So he wrote an article. He posted it on September 5th. It's called HIIT, HIIT, or HIIRT. And, you know, we won't go too much in. This is a very workout technical article, but what he's seeking to do is differentiate and teach people a little bit about what these distinctions mean. And I know me personally, I can even go back a couple years, and HIIT and HIIT, honestly, sometimes I mix the two up. And so let's go over just the first two really briefly. Actually, let's go over them all really briefly. HIIT is high intensity training. And usually high intensity training is referring to something that involves one set to failure, super slow, something like that. That's the classic HIIT protocol. HIIT is high intensity interval training. And one famous example of that would be Tabata intervals that we've talked about on here. All out for 20 seconds, rest for 10 seconds. And they've been studied most often in conjunction, as Keith will say, with sprints or cycle sessions. HIIRT, which is a lot of what Keith is focused on, is high intensity interval resistance training. So it's really taking elements of HIIT and those Tabatas and throwing in resistance work, strength work, along with, let's say, the cycling or sprinting. Bam.
That's good stuff. I get those mixed up all the time.
Yeah, so it's a great article. It's a great article to wrap your head around, because I think a lot of the popular workout types, you know, CrossFit's obviously out there all over the place on the scene. It's useful to know what these places are founding their exercises on. And honestly, a lot of what we do at Relentless Fitness, we work a lot of HIIRT and a lot of HIIT. Yeah. So we are, like Keith, throwing a lot of those resistance exercises in there along with the sprints and cycles. And that's generally speaking what I believe the most in.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. Did you know that Keith Norris doesn't do push-ups? He pushes the earth down.
So I think that's going to have to be protocol in here. If we ever quote Keith, we'll have to bring in a new Chuck Norris joke.
Yeah, absolutely. I gotta refresh some of those.
So we'll link to it. It's a good read, especially if you're really into the exercise portion. Even if you're not, and let's say you do CrossFit and you're just not into what's going on behind the scenes, maybe it's worth a read.
I think it's good stuff. Next up, so we have gotten several questions in the last week since our Bulletproof Breakfast podcast about mycotoxins in coffee. So first things first, when we were discussing Bulletproof Breakfast, we were mostly discussing putting grass-fed butter in your coffee.
Yep.
Saying it's a good way to add calories to your breakfast, a quicker way to do it, and for those of you that have trouble downing food in the morning, a good way to do it. I know that there is also the Bulletproof coffee per se, and the big thing there is...
Actually, I want to throw in a correction and thank Chuck, our listener, for pointing this out. The coffee brand itself is called Upgraded Coffee.
Oh, that's Upgraded Coffee.
So the brand is, I guess, Bulletproof Exec, and the coffee is called Upgraded Coffee. So that's what we keep talking about.
I'm just thoroughly confused.
Speaking of, we thought HIIT, HIIT, yeah, and HIIRT was confusing. Now we're going off on this coffee tangent. Yeah.
So we've gotten a lot of questions because if you go to Upgraded Coffee, he says it's mycotoxin free, and I haven't read this all, so I'm just quoting what people have said to us, and that, you know, there's a lot of mycotoxins in coffee out there, and this is one way to avoid those. They could have health implications, etc. And a lot of questions say, is this true?
Sure.
And I did a pretty decent lit search on this, and there really isn't a ton of stuff to substantiate those kind of claims. So I don't know if it's Dave Asprey.
Asprey, yeah.
Dave, yeah, Asprey. I don't know. You know, I'm sure he has some data, et cetera. So I don't want to discredit what he's saying. And, you know, the other issue is, are there mycotoxins in normal organic coffee that you get at, you know, Whole Foods or wherever, which is what I drink. I don't get the upgraded. And so I found one article from 1980, which is a great year because I was born that year. And I think the older articles are generally a little bit better. But anyway, So very interesting article where this guy Levi, he reported on several studies concerning the susceptibility of green coffee beans to mycotoxin contamination. So similar to what we talked about. He looked at investigations on normal mold flora, toxin production in beans, experimental roasting, and its effect on aflatoxin. And aflatoxin is a it does cause a liver cancer. It is a risk for liver cancer, so that's a bad thing. Ochratoxin, which I'm not familiar with, and stearigmastocystin, which I'm not familiar with either, and the presence of these toxins in commercial green coffee. And his findings were, it's very interesting the way he puts it, because of the extremely low frequency of findings, the low levels of toxins, so there's low levels of toxins even in coffee beans, and the experimental data shows that 70 to 80% of the toxins are destroyed by the roasting process. Further study on this topic has been discontinued. So this would favor that there aren't so many toxins in...
That it's not necessarily a critical difference.
Yeah, so I don't, you know, what's, how much do you want to put the, what Rob Wolf said, the tinfoil hat on?
Yeah.
I don't know, there's definitely not data to make a strong recommendation one way or the other.
And you made a great point, and that point is, you know, how much difference is there between an already, let's say, organic brand that you're buying at Whole Foods, or maybe an organic brand that you're getting from a... like a stump town or something like that. How much difference is there between that and a quote-unquote mycotoxin-free coffee? I'm not sure. How much difference is there between that and Folgers? You know, who?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that either.
The other question, too, is are we sure his is 100% mycotoxin-free? How do you even ensure that?
Yeah.
And is there coffee that's 100% mycotoxin? I mean, it's growing in the ground. There's mold. There's bacteria, et cetera. Yeah. A lot of variables there. I'm not discrediting it at all, but there's not a lot of support here either, so I don't know.
So more work to be done in that
field. More work to be done, yeah.
And in the meantime, we'll keep drinking our coffee. So speaking of, what kind of coffee are you drinking?
I've been doing the Costa Rican organic breakfast blend from Starbucks.
Very nice.
It's delicious. I found the yellower the beans, the more flavorful for me. What do you do?
Right now I scooped some 100% same organic an African blend from Whole Foods.
Okay.
I'm actually really liking it. It's been quite enjoyable.
Yeah.
So sounds like we're both pretty satisfied with our coffee.
The mycotoxins are eating my brain. But,
you know what's funny? I'll give a quick coffee story. And it's funny the different answers I get in my transformation consultations to a letter, to a head. I mean, almost everyone drinks coffee. More often than not, if I do run into someone who says, I don't drink coffee, I'm mildly surprised because I expect that they drink at least a little bit. So I've sat down with, I guess, over the past week and a half, let's say 15 people between the two transformations. And I think every single one of them has drank coffee in some form. And it's just amazing. It's so funny the different answers I get where I say, do you drink coffee or do you drink coffee with cream and sugar? And then you just get all these different answers back. You know, some people, when they say I drink coffee, they mean coffee. They mean black coffee. They're comfortable with that. They roll with that. And then others, it's, well, what do you drink it with? And it's, you know, some sugar, some cream or some milk or this or that.
It's like a meal.
Yeah. And it's funny, I guess sometimes liquids don't get the respect that solids do. Because if I don't prompt with that question, we move right on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's what do you drink? Coffee. Oh, okay. Let's move on. But then when I dig a little deeper, I drink coffee with some creamers. I drink coffee with some sugars.
It's 20 grams of sugar.
Right. Yeah. Oh, whoa. Well, all right. That's a little bit of a different story.
Yeah, man.
Respect the liquids.
Respect the liquids.
They matter just as much as the solids.
So I have been absolutely obsessed as of recently with diaphragm breathing. And what diaphragm breathing is, it's basically belly breathing. So when you take a breath in, your stomach extends forward and actually extends backwards, pushing into your lumbar spine. And if I have a couple of videos here, but if you think about a baby, when you lay a baby on its back, how its belly kind of protrudes in and out when it breathes, that's diaphragm breathing. And my brother is a big proponent of diaphragm breathing. He says it's the cause of like all issues. So if your knee hurts, it's like, oh, you're not breathing properly. And, but he's been really big about back pain and diaphragm breathing. And so I've been trying it. I've been trying it a lot. I think he knows his stuff. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. And when I am in the operating room, I do prostate brachytherapy. It's like radioactive seeds. And you stand for a while, and you stand in these weird positions, like I'm bending over and I'm inserting these needles in, and it just destroys my back. My back is just killing me. And in between cases, I always kind of squat down, put my knees under my arms, so they're kind of up into my armpit to round my back off, to mm-hmm. basically open it up and kind of let my spinal cord release. And it's just not working. And I wear Vibrams in there. I've got rid of the big shoes, etc. So I've started diaphragm breathing during it, and it's amazing because first off, when you do it, it naturally pushes back on your lower back. So when I roll my back forward to kind of release my spinal cord, etc., it's naturally doing that by itself. So I've noticed I don't need to stop and do that anymore in between cases. And frankly, at the end of the day, my back does not hurt. I've never had such a quick fix for lower back pain as doing this.
That's great.
Yeah. And so for you listeners out there, please try it.
Especially ones with recurrent back pain.
Yeah. And so I researched this, you know, is it in my head? Am I out of my mind? And I'm actually not that crazy. I'll post for you guys a great study. And the title of the study is Individuals with Low Back Pain Breathe Differently Than Individuals During a Lifting Task. So that's kind of exactly what we're talking about. It's in the Journal of Orthopedic Sports Physical Therapy. And in this study, they took 62 participants, 30 without lower back pain and 32 with low back pain, for at least a year in duration. And they made them do a total of 8 self-paced lifts of a crate from the floor and then some other types of lifts. They loaded it to 25% of their weight. They basically measured the amount of volume in the lungs. And what they found was that people with lower back pain, especially chronic low back pain, performed lifting tasks with more inhaled lung volume than individuals with lower back pain. And they say these findings are consistent with the theoretical link between breath control, intra-abdominal pressure, and lumbar segmental control. So I thought about, does this actually make sense? And going back to my lifting days, when I'm maxing out, et cetera, I guess my lifting days aren't over, but, you know, you always would breathe in and you kind of hold your breath and it gets that abdominal pressure up.
Sure.
So then, you know, thinking more and more what's going on here. And if you think about it, your diaphragm, so when you access it to basically, bring in some air, when you don't do that, when you let it go into your lungs, you actually lose that stability. Your diaphragm's less effective at stabilizing the lumbar spine. So that to me makes sense. The other issue, when it pushes back on your lumbar spine, it really does release the spine. And there's other article that I read, which I can't find right now, said it increases blood flow to the spine. Another thing said, when the diaphragm opens up, it pushes lymph out because lymph is a passive flow system. It's not like your blood pressure. So I don't know. There's a lot of reasons here, but it works.
So there's something going on there.
There's something going on here. There's people that have low back pain aren't doing diaphragm breathing. So, and for me, I know it is a damn easy change to make. You just start belly breathing, etc. And my last ploy to get you all out there to try it, they took 16 athletes in another study titled Diaphragmatic Breathing Reduces Exercise-Induced Oxidative Stress. They took 16 athletes. They put them through an exhaustive training session. I don't know if it was HIIT. I don't know if it was HHI or what. But they put them through an exhaustive training, and they put half them afterwards, they just would let them sit there and kind of relax for an hour. The other half would sit there and relax and perform diaphragmatic breathing and really concentrated on their breath. They found that the group that did the diaphragmatic breathing had a significant decrease in cortisol, which is an inflammatory hormone. They had an increase in melatonin, which we already discussed, which I posted about in the sleep article. Melatonin is an antioxidant. And then the other thing is they measured reactive oxygen metabolites, so that's aka free radicals, in the system, and found that they were significantly decreased in those that did diaphragmatic breathing. So it may even help you recover better from your workouts.
That is some interesting stuff, man.
So yeah, I'm sold. I do it in the gym. I do it throughout the day. I'm always concentrating on it.
The neat thing about that is, what's the real risk of adoption, you know, of giving that a 10-minute experiment and, you know, watching a short video and seeing how it feels, and, you know, maybe you learn to breathe a little bit better.
Yeah. It's free. It's easy.
Yeah.
So everyone out there, try it.
I'm totally sold on it. So speaking, you just actually initiated some buzzwords, segued perfectly into this article over here. You brought up your sleep article and you used the word melatonin. And so we have an article right here. Using iPads before bed can lead to a poor night's sleep. Surprise, surprise. Colin, you talked about blue light in your sleep article, and blue light suppresses the production of melatonin. And we're carrying these iPads. I know I am sometimes carrying these iPads into bed and using that, you know, turning all the lights off and almost using that as the final thing that my eyes are exposed to. And the thing is that these pads, I think they used, this article refers to Apple's iPad and Samsung's Galaxy Note, actually emit stronger blue light.
Wow.
So that's a problem.
Yep.
Especially when it's, I imagine I'm not the only one out there that sometimes has that as the last thing that they see, before they shut that off and then try to go to bed. So it's going to screw with your melatonin production.
And that's going to, melatonin's going to make you sleepier too. It's going to make you be able to fall asleep much quicker. Yep. So you want it secreted before you actually go to bed.
Yep. And so, this could be a problem.
Yeah.
I guess it's not a shocker, but it's more of one of those reminders that hopefully just us talking about this, if you are like me, because I know now I'm going to go home tonight and not use my iPad before bed. So this has been productive, right? This article has been productive. There may be nights in the future where I go back to it, but I think this is always going to be in the back of my mind now. So if we could jog some of you out there, maybe you use the iPad for 15 minutes, then you shift to even just a regular book for 15 minutes and you have that be the last thing you do and you just start getting back in those natural rhythms a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very interesting that it's blue light too. Because if you think about fire and flame, et cetera, we're adapted now to having a red or yellow or no light prior to bed.
Yeah.
Which causes melatonin release from the pineal gland. So interesting.
And one other thing that this article recommends, maybe you don't want to give up the iPad or the Galaxy or whatever. If you can dim the screen, do so.
We'll do the, I don't know if that iFlux makes only lets orange light through once sun sets. I have it on my laptop.
So that's another.
I don't know if it works for I hate Apple. I'm anti-Apple, as you know. So I don't know if it works for iPad or not. So just throw your iPads away.
So check out that program, Flux. Also, see if you can dim the screen. And alternatively, I mean, the best solution is, again, just ditch it before bed and go to a regular book or nothing at all.
Sounds good. We'll link iFlux in the notes. I think it's i.flx or flux.
I think it's, yeah, it's all right. Yeah, we'll link it. It's something along those lines. Sounds good.
Tangible takeaways.
Exercise time?
Let's do it. Take us off.
All right. My big thing recently is experimenting with workout times. Here at Relentless Fitness, we do, you know, some 30-minute sessions, 45-minute sessions, and 60-minute sessions. And I have to say, early in my training career, I wanted hours, you know, I didn't know any different. It was just, well, an hour is the longest session. It has to be better, right? More has to be better. And I think over time, I really gravitated to the 45s. I thought 45 was great. It allowed us to warm up effectively. It allowed us to cool down and kind of recap and talk the workout out. I got to be honest, half hours are looking mighty good to me these days. And you know, a lot of it is, of course, how intensely you do treat a workout, but I am preferential these days to the half hours. And so I myself have adopted a workout regimen that's really focusing around 3 half-hour workouts that are, 2 of which are definitely intense, but there are definitely some intensity elements across all 3, that are spaced out over the course of a week. And that's been working well, even during these stressful few weeks. Thus far, it's been working very well for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's the way to be kind of realistic with yourself. You've been working crazy hours. You're obviously not going to go to the gym 7 days a week and work out for an hour. That will not be healthy.
Right.
I have, surprise, surprise, my exercise is more breathing.
Oh, man.
So Bill Hartman, he runs this thing called iFast. It's in, Indianapolis.
And he is not in conjunction with Apple, right?
No, he's not.
All right. Just wanted to make sure.
He's a pretty good dude, apparently. My brother goes down there a lot. Like I said, my brother's really big on this kind of stuff. And he has, I'm going to post this, in the notes, he has 2 videos and a assessment on breathing patterns. And he shows you kind of the wrong way to do it and the right way to do it. The wrong way is when that, you know, your chest is rising. It really should just be your belly. And, he has some exercises as well. And, you know, he says over time, improper breathing can lead to back pain, neck pain, shoulder pain, or lower extremity issues. So I think this is just a hugely important point. That's why I'm beating the dead horse repeatedly, bringing this up again and again. But yeah, that's my exercise, because I think if you do this, it's going to make your exercise in the gym that much better.
And also, like you said, referring back to the other article, that your breathing patterns during heavy exercise could be affecting you.
Absolutely.
So if you correct those patterns, not only can it help your everyday, but it may be able to help your heavy lifting when you're probably most exposed to risk anyway.
Absolutely.
Right?
You want your diaphragm to be stable when you're popping 200 pounds over your head.
Yep. Absolutely.
Food.
Yeah, why don't you start?
I've been looking forward to this.
Nutrition.
I did a self-experiment over the last several weeks where I was just kind of dogging it in the gym. I don't know if you guys remember, a couple weeks ago, I was just saying I was just the worst workouts, getting in there and actually leaving. So I just said, you know what, screw it. I'm increasing my calories by about 500 to 1,000 per day.
Okay.
And just see what happened. And I try to push it. I try to work out to my fullest every time I go into the gym. So no changing in my workout. Just increasing my calories 500 to 1,000. And really not increasing my cardiovascular stuff. You know, I still play volleyball every once in a while, walk around a lot, and then do some sprints.
Mm-hmm.
And the results have just been out of control. My strength is through the roof. I'm actually much more defined than I was a month ago. So it's just really interesting that I increased my calories by 500 to 1,000 a day, and I actually end up losing. I mean, I'm gaining weight. It's all muscle mass. I've actually lost fat. And I think a big part of it is I've just had so much more fuel to work out in the weight room.
Well, you know what it reminds me of? I believe this was last episode, was the study that you brought up where there was severe caloric restriction. And what actually happened was the metabolic rate would slow down.
Yeah.
And then they would try to exercise on top of that. And then the metabolic rate would slow down even more. And it's that body trying to, you know, protect homeostasis.
Yeah.
Right? So maybe you were a little calorically restricted, because obviously you eat very well.
Yeah.
You know, your selection's spot on. So maybe you were under eating a little bit.
And it shows, good point. It shows the homeostasis thing where you jack up your calories. You don't just start gaining weight overnight like everyone would make you believe. Your body doesn't want to, it wants to stay the same. So what does it do? It increases your metabolic rate.
Yep.
So it's interesting. I actually lost a significant amount of fat. Feeling good.
Yep. And really this, just to hammer home, you know, if you're eating and that, I see it more often than I would want, but for someone, you know, even trying to lose weight and eating in that brutal range, you know, whether it be 800, 900 calories, 1,100 calories, somewhere around there, it's tough.
Yeah. You know, you're not going to feel good.
You'll lose a little weight, but then the body's going to start to really creep to a halt. And sometimes you may have to counterintuitively eat a little bit more and see what happens.
Yep. Eat clean and eat till you're no longer hungry.
Yep. All right. So I thought I'd bring up, for my nutrition today, I thought I'd bring up a discussion about macronutrient breakdowns, because I know we get a lot of carbohydrate questions and, just, you know, what kinds of things you eat in the morning all the way through to the night. And specifically, my question revolves around macros, you know, when's the fat coming in there? When's the protein? When are the carbohydrates coming in there? You know, do you pay attention to them? You know, does it matter? And, you know, do you keep each meal well-rounded, or do you sort of rotate? No, I'll lead. Where recently what I've been doing is, I've mentioned my breakfast. I think I mentioned that on the last show as well. I go heavy on the protein and fat in the morning. I go very usually low carbohydrate. That works very well for me. If I am having carbohydrate in the morning, it's usually in the form of sautéed vegetables along with the protein and fat. My lunch is usually the most well-rounded meal of the day. And I definitely get some solid fat in there, some solid protein, and some solid carb. Well, maybe a little lower carbohydrate. Usually a whole piece of fruit, something along those lines. And then later at night is actually when I'm getting my biggest dose of carbohydrate, usually in the form of sweet potato, paired with a protein, and that's my lowest fat meal of the day. So that's my current breakdown. Again, I am active pretty much all day. I'm on my feet a lot, getting, you know, at least those few workouts in, doing lots of walking, lots of exercise demonstration and whatnot. So I feel pretty good about I got the air quotes going. I feel pretty good about the safe starch later on.
Yeah.
How about you, man?
So what I've been doing, and I don't deviate from this much. I just, even with the increase in calories, I just kind of increase every meal.
Yeah.
The morning, I barely do any carbs. Me and carbs do not get along in the morning. We've had a falling out. So I do mostly fat with a chunk of protein. But I think in the morning, I'm like 70% fat.
Mm-hmm.
I try to get some vegetables in, some like kale or the most carb-dense vegetables in the morning I have is orange peppers,
mm-hmm.
Which I like because I can bring them. They're mobile. I could easily bring them to work. But I have a lot of trouble getting a lot of vegetables in the morning just because I'm just not ready to eat that much. Lunch is maybe a little more carbs in terms of green leafy vegetables or maybe some more of the peppers, colorful. But I still don't hit. There's a small window in my day when I actually do carbs.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm really trying to put weight on, I will increase carbs during my lunch meal. But like yesterday I had a half a pound of salmon and then just a ton of vegetables cooked in ghee. So it's, you know, mostly a fat protein meal. But my protein does go up. And then before and after I work out, I carb load out of a sweet potato with butter and protein. The butter's a lot, so I'm still hitting, you know, 30, 40% fat. And then one of those will be a protein shake with fruit, so berries or whatnot.
Okay.
And then my last meal of the day, I do not touch carb. I'll have a glass of wine with it, but it's usually a big hunky piece of meat, fatty piece of meat. So we're looking like 60-70% fat, 40% protein. And then,
but you're also coming off of a period where you've I don't want to throw out carb loaded as a term, but you've eaten more carbs. So
yeah, exactly. And then and frankly, like kale, green leafy vegetables, I don't even count those as carbs because mm-hmm. there's so few carbs that I actually care about in there. So yeah, I'm a big fan of carbs peri-workout, you know, right before and, you know, within an hour after, a half hour after.
Yep.
That seems to work well.
Sounds good. Thought we'd just talk a little bit about that. And
no, it's good.
I think it's always interesting to hear what other people are doing. And if anyone out there has any, you know, any sort of different macro breakdown that's working for them, you know, send it on in and certainly digest that.
Good stuff. We're ready to do it?
It's time.
Caveman Corner. So my big thing, and this is the like proper alignment day. You know, a lot of the listeners out there, where you guys are all trying to improve your health, and that's awesome. We applaud you. And some of you guys are crazier than others, and some of you guys are really crazy. And I think Roger and I would see us as in that boat of psychotically craziness.
Can I interject something here?
Sure.
You know what always cracks me up? So we're both big fans of Rob Wolf, right?
Mm-hmm.
So on his show, sometimes he talks about so-and-so being on the quote-unquote lunatic fringe of whatever. The funny part to me is we're kind of all on the lunatic fringe. The people he refers to as on the lunatic fringe are lunatics.
Yeah.
They're the full-blown lunatics.
We're all
on the lunatic fringe. So I just wanted to clarify
relative.
That there, right? But hey, in my world, and I think you'd agree in our world, being on the lunatic fringe of caring about your own health, I think there are a lot worse places to be.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of these things, I'm trying to put out some really simple points today. Of course, breathing is a big one. But walking. So many people are just so into their health. They eat, they weigh everything, they write it down, they eat so cleanly. And then you look at them walk, and their one foot sticking out, their hips are not aligned. It's just such a easy thing, you know, walk with your feet forward, have your toes pointing forward, don't have your one leg out to the right. Usually, I can't remember if it's the left. I think it's usually the right leg that's cocked outwards a little bit. But, you know, you could be doing everything right, and then in 20 or 30 years, you're going to end up at the orthopedist with a banged up knee or lower back pain because of something as simple as you're not breathing right or you're not walking right. So really think about it. Google some videos on appropriate way to walk, and then you're going to, once you start doing it, you're going to notice how wrongly everyone else walks, and you're going to drive yourself totally nuts. Because it is like a pet peeve of mine, and most people don't even realize. Like, no one's actually thought about their walking.
Dr. Champ runs around. Sometimes when we're walking around in the streets, he'll yell at somebody across the street for not walking right.
I literally want to, but I just gripe to you. Roger just sits there listening to me complain about people not walking appropriately, even though they have no clue what they're even doing. But yeah, you know, think about it. That and breathing might make some big change. For me personally, those have been two huge changes in my life. I tore my ACL and broke my right leg playing basketball during medical school, and I've just always had knee pain since. And when I started walking right, it's just the change was just through the roof.
Dramatic.
So that is my big takeaway.
And if you're not walking, start.
Yeah.
That's my big gripe.
Walk more and walk right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I really don't think you can walk too much.
Yeah. Nope.
So I think walking is a huge X factor too. It's one of those things that doesn't seem to make all that difference. Like if there's one thing you'd cut out of your day, it would be the walking. But honestly, that stuff adds up. It's just that low level motion keeps you active. It's just, good head clearing device. We've talked about that before.
Absolutely.
All right, man. Relentless Report over here. And my big thing today is prioritization of your health. And so one of the things recently, I started doing is waking up at an earlier time and allowing myself time for breakfast. So I'm not talking slap something together, grab it on the road and shove it down my face as I'm heading to work. I'm talking about leaving the time to wake up, to relax a little bit, to cook properly, make myself up a cup of coffee, sit down, read a few articles if I want, like really ease into that day and enjoy that breakfast. And I think it's easy. You know, we all run, hey, we're all stressed, right? We all work hard and, you know, have family lives and different people have different stressors, but we're all stressed. Sometimes it doesn't seem so realistic to wake up 45 minutes earlier to cook yourself some breakfast and sit down for a few minutes. But if you can get yourself into some of those positive routines and, you know, I'm killing a few birds with one stone here. I'm giving myself the chance to eat perfectly. You know, right? To take in the foods exactly how I want them without having to go and scrounge at like a Wawa or a Starbucks or something like that. I'm eating exactly what I want to eat. And so I promote my health there. And also you had brought up something a few episodes back and that was, meditation, it doesn't have to be explicit meditation. It can be if you're walking, listening to an audiobook, or if you enjoy reading a few articles, it can honestly just be losing yourself in an article or two. And for me, it gives me time to just sit down, chill out, and start my day right. And I've really appreciated it. So whereas 4 months ago, I probably would have slept until I had to wake up, shower, and then head out the door. Now I am more than happy to wake up about a full hour earlier just to cook that breakfast. And so what I'm trying to do on the back end is make the commitment to go to bed earlier.
Turn off that iPod.
Right, turn exactly.
Or the iPad, excuse me.
Yep, turn it off.
So, no, that's great stuff. Prioritize.
Yep.
If you're getting to work and you're hungry all morning and you're dragging because of it, wake up 30, 40,
yep,
an hour earlier.
And I just feel like we all deserve that stuff. Like we all deserve to be able to prioritize our own health. It improves everything. It improves the quality of, your friendships, your relationships, your kids, just everything out there improves. You become a better functioning person when you have your health clicking.
Yeah. Could you imagine if Roethlisberger got up just 45 minutes earlier? He would have thrown like 4 TDs last game and not a pick 6 to end it.
You know it's time to end this show when it degrades into Pittsburgh Steelers talk.
It's going to be a tough year.
Maybe for the both of us.
Yeah. But no, man, I'm with you 100%. Prioritize. It just makes such a big difference.
Absolutely. So, hey, this man is Dr. Colin Champ. You can find him on cavemandoctor.com. He'll have the episode posted there. Drop him a comment. You can find me on, it's actually relentlessroger.com. And I can stop saying rogerdickerman.com. That's my name, Roger Dickerman. But I think we have Relentless Roger now. Anyway,
nice.
One of the two, somewhere in there. That's where I'm going to post the episode. Please say hi and drop a comment there. As always, you can find us on iTunes, Relentless Roger and the Caveman Doctor, episode 17.
Have a good week.
See you guys.